Barry Newman's my name, and it's lovely to be here again. It really is always lovely, and it's great to have my wife here as well. She's normally at some other church tinkering around on pianos or organs or something like that. Not quite sure what she does, but she does it very well. Many years ago, I actually came across this story, which relates probably to the 19th century. There was a small town, I think, somewhere in the United States, and there was a council meeting in progress. And someone delivered a little note to someone, one of the members of the council, and this began to circulate. And then finally, obviously it was disturbing people, it was read out. There was a person in the town who was intellectually very handicapped. He actually was given the name by townspeople as Silly Billy. His name is Bill, and they described his intellectual expertise or lack thereof by using that phrase, silly, so Silly Billy. What had happened was that Silly Billy apparently had some skill in rhyme, and he had got someone to write down a little piece of poetry. And this was on the paper that was being circulated. And it simply said, this can Silly Billy see, three in one and one in three, and one of these has died for me. Well, Silly Billy wasn't all that silly. He was actually very clever. In this time of year where many students are really struggling with HSC preparation, I had one of my grandsons just yesterday, watched him do some basketball, and then as I drove him home, I said, what are we going to do now? He said, I'll be studying. He's not even in the HSC. He's only in year nine, I think, but I'll be studying. There's tremendous pressure on people to work very hard in a particular area. Knowledge, understanding, and certain skills associated with it. But the Bible doesn't rate that sort of thing as of prime importance. It rates knowledge as important, but knowledge which leads to godliness and how to be really clever from God's point of view is associated with our hunger for righteousness and being able to deal with it. Now, in the little Bible reading we had, there's a parable. The parable actually has an extraordinary poetic structure to it, which we don't convey in the English at all. Jesus constructed this parable. It appears from everything we have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that Jesus is very clever with his handling of words, just with handling of words. He appears to be very, very clever with his ability to construct poems and things of a poetic nature and stories of a poetic nature. Most people don't appreciate that about Jesus, but he obviously was highly skilled in this area. So what we had read to us was a parable which has a poetic structure to it. It has seven actual stanzas, and each stanza has three lines. But as I said, we won't pick that up in our English reading. Then, in fact, he has a little poem. And this poem, again, has so many stanzas, three stanzas, and in it, I think, each stanza has six little lines. But again, we won't actually see that. And then we have a little reference to the Pharisees. The parable is probably the most difficult parable to understand of all the parables that Jesus uttered. So what are we doing looking at it? Well, sometimes it's not a bad idea to tackle hard things. And I've got to say at the outset, look, the people who write about this particular parable differ enormously on how they understand it, and who am I to say that somehow or other I will have got it all right? I probably will get some of it wrong. That's got to be the case, given how difficult the parable is and how divergent, how varied the views are. But anyway, what we do need to do to start with, because this is part of our difficulty anyway, is understanding, what we need to do is understand the cultural background to the parable. There's no point in looking at it as though it was something belonging to the 20th or the 21st century. This belongs to the first century, and it belongs to what we would now call Israel. It belongs to that part of the world. It's a farming sort of a parable. What we have is a very wealthy man, and he owns a lot of land, and some of the land, this is the backdrop, this is how people would have understood it when Jesus was telling the story that he made up. This rich person had a lot of land, and he rented out parts of his land to people who would grow crops on it or do something like that. So that, for instance, we have in the story that Jesus made up a person who actually has some olive trees. And he uses the olive trees year after year to get the olive oil. At the end of his year, when he actually collects all this oil, then he pays rent to the rich man. In another field, there's a fellow growing wheat. And at the end of the year, when his harvest is brought in, there will be a contract whereby he will pay his rent when the wheat crop is brought in. Now that's the sort of backdrop to the story. What we do have is not only a rich man and these particular two renters who are using the land of the rich man, we have an estate manager. He's an agent who works on behalf of the rich man. He's in his employ, and he's involved, among many other things, of collecting the rent and negotiating, perhaps, with these people who are running the land. So the story begins with a very short story. The story begins with the wealthy man calling in the estate manager. And obviously, someone's been talking to him about how the estate manager has been running things, and he's probably been taking some cream off the rental that's had to have come in for himself, or he's actually been saying to the people, actually, you need to pay me something under the table so I can keep the master happy. Who knows what he's been doing? You've just got to invent it as you sort of hear the story. But this is a dishonest estate manager. And someone has been talking to the ear of the rich man saying, hey, you know what your estate manager's been doing? So the estate manager, is called in by the rich man. I did drop my glasses somewhere, which I will need later on.
Behind you.
Behind me? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A lot of things are behind me. So what the owner says to the estate manager is simply this, you're sacked. You're no longer in my employ whatsoever. And you will need to bring in the account book. You will need to actually bring in the book that actually has these rentals and so on written into it. I will need that, of course, now to give to a new estate manager. I need the control of things. And do that quickly. Now, one of the things I think Jesus is saying as he tells this story is this particular rich man is actually a rather kind rich man. Because under normal circumstances, he would have called in the authorities and the estate manager would have been put in jail. There is no question about that happening. He simply says, you've lost your job. Now, the estate manager does some very quick thinking. He's desperate. His whole world is crumbling around him. He's probably lived fairly well under the arrangements. This is the backdrop to the story. As far as he can work out, no one else, of course, yet knows that he's been sacked. He does have the account books. What's he going to do in the future? He says, oh, look, I'm not that sort of a person who can dig. I'm not going to be a day labourer. Just haven't got the strength to do that. What else? Oh, the worst of all possibilities. I can become a beggar. In other words, absolutely dependent upon other people's generosity. Oh, how shameful. I can't do that. I've got an idea. Look, I take it that no one yet knows that I've been sacked. I've got the account books. I'm going to send out, by the way, it shows you how important it is. He makes the command on those who are renting the property to come and see him. So he summons them. Hey, I want you all in quickly. I've got something to talk to you about. So they come in, and of course you've just got the two little scenarios that are spelled out for you in the story that Jesus made up. Now listen, here's the account material for you. What does it say? Read it out. Yes, it says 100. 100 barrels of oil. Right, we'll cross that out. Right, 50. What, 50? Now you see, is your understanding the story? You're now saying, from the point of view of those people who are land renters, they're amazed. They say, wow. Obviously the master, the rich man's very generous. I don't know what reason's going on, but apparently he's had a windfall somewhere else, and he's actually going to charge us less. And he wipes, in this case, 50% off the bill. He calls in, and he does it separately, so they mustn't talk to each other. He sends them off. Go away. Come in. Next one. You're in charge of that was the olive trees. You're in charge of the wheat. You've got the wheat growing on your land. Now, what does it say there? Uh-huh. Right, 100. Make it 80. You sign it, I'll countersign it, and so on. Again, this sort of amazement. Wow. Very simple story. and this man is very dishonest. He's actually very clever. He's very shrewd. What is he trying to do? He's trying to save himself. Undoubtedly, that's the case. He's in a desperate situation. You see, in that sort of a world, word would go out very, very quickly. Hey, guess what? I don't understand why. My rental's actually been cut by the equivalent of, in both cases, by the way, 500 denarii. It's about that, which is equivalent to about a year and a half's day labourer's wages. My rent has just been cut enormously. And this spreads around the local community. Everyone very quickly will hear about how generous the landowner is. I don't know how it's come about, but we've just had our rents reduced substantially. Very, very generous man. Very, very generous man. Now, in the course of time, word comes back to the landowner. This is the backdrop to the story. This is the sort of stuff you would understand. You've got these renters who are praising your name for how generous you've been. He says, what? What do you mean generous? Well, in fact, you instructed through your land agent, your estate manager, you instructed him to reduce the rent substantially. Oh, did I now? Did I now? Now, he's got two possibilities, this landowner. Well, I suppose he's got a number, but he's got two important possibilities. He can actually say to people, look, I've got a very dishonest estate manager. I actually had sacked him. After I had sacked him, understandably, before you knew about it, he went and he made you, and he was part to it, alter the books. I'm sorry. It will have to return to the original value, because that was what we agreed upon, and it's only because of this dishonest bloke that's been in my employ that I sacked that, in fact, the situation has arisen. Now, that's one possibility. But if he does that, the people in the community, including those people who've been renting the land, will say, oh, come off it. I thought we were on a windfall ourselves here. Oh, come on. Couldn't you be a bit more generous? The second possibility is, in fact, to act exceedingly generous. See, he's this landowner is generous to start with. He doesn't put the fellow in jail. He just says, no longer in my employ. And now, given the scenario of what's happened, his generosity, I think, comes to the fore. That's the way I think you're supposed to read it. He basically says, oh, okay, right, oh, that's nice, that's good. He wants to be known in his world as a very generous person because generous he is. And that's the end of the parable. Well, is it the end of the parable? Now, this is really tricky because this is where people disagree. Either Jesus now takes over and makes a comment, or the landowner makes a comment and then has Jesus say something, or then the landowner makes a couple of comments. So there's our possibilities. It is difficult. See, it's a very difficult one. And by the way, this particular parable was chosen at one particular point in time, I can't remember exactly where it was, as an anti-Christian story. Look what this Jesus is supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be saying, what a good fellow it is to be dishonest. Well, what an awful religion. So actually used against Christianity, right? Because anyway, this is what you've got. I think this is what does indeed happen. I think the landowner actually says, not a bad bloke from some points of view, this estate manager. He commends the estate manager for his shrewdness, being very clever. See, what he's done is he's been desperate for survival, right? But secondly, his whole strategy has been worked out on the basis that the landowner will be merciful and generous. These are two parts together. Desperate for survival. Secondly, he's worked out it's all going to work only if it will work, it'll be because the landowner will be exceedingly generous. It depends on two things: his own strategy, but in the end, ultimately, how generous will the landowner be? And in fact, the landowner in the parable that Jesus tells, because it does fit into the poetry, by the way, exactly this way, the landowner says, wow, well, from some points of view, he's a remarkable man. I commend him for his wisdom, for his being clever. Now, at the end of the story, it's not as though you have to say, oh, what happened then? What happened then? Well, you can make it up if you like, but that's the end of the story. Except that maybe he does continue to say these words. And Jesus, who's telling the story, this is my view, Jesus, who's telling the story, does not make it clear that the last few words actually are part of the story or part of his own comment. So he's telling the story. And as he tells the story and fills it out, you can listen to it. And you can hear the last few words that he says, and you can say to yourself, oh, is that what the manager is saying? Is that what the estate owner is saying? Or is it what this teacher is saying? And I don't think you'd be able to tell easily at all. This is the last part of the account. Because he commended the dishonest manager for the sons or the children of his age or this age are wiser than the children of light in their own generation. This is where people disagree a lot. That little phrase, in their own generation, can be attached either to, and that's probably the way I think it was read out, either to the sons of this age, or the sons of this world, the children of this world, or you can attach it to the sons of light. Now, sons of light is a phrase used by Paul in his letter to the Thessalonians. Almost always you would use it as a reference to righteous people, sons of light. But in their own generation, what does that mean? Sons of light in their own generation. I think it means this: sons of light in their own world, in their own club, in their own clique, in their own family. That's the way the gene, the Greek, in fact, can be understood. And then what would be the reference? Sons of light in their own world. The Pharisees. It's a bit of irony. At least that's my take on it. So what is Jesus now actually trying to teach us? We've got to learn something from this. We've got to take something on board. We've got to become the clever ones. I think Jesus is teaching this. To be really, really clever, I'm just putting that in, to be really, really clever, we need to know we're in desperate need. We need help. We've got to really take that on board. We've got to take it on seriously. And to be really, really clever, we've got to understand that it's only because of the mercy of God that there's any hope for us at all. You go any other way, think in any other direction about how to solve the problem of our sinfulness, our wickedness, our stupidity, go any other way than depend on the mercy of God, and you are a fool, is what God says to us. Do you want to be really, really clever? You need to know you're in desperate need. And you need to realize that God only holds the solution. Only in his mercy can the problem be solved. And then you'll be really, really clever. And you'll be far more clever than those people who are so self-righteous in their own little clubs, getting together, as it were, to commend one another to each other, to praise one another to each other. to try and build up this sort of a image about yourself so that people say, oh, what a nice person, what a good person that is. You'll be far more clever than they could ever be. I think that's what the story is. Well, now, we've got to just quickly finish us the last little bit, though. It's to do with the famous passage to do with mammon, as it gets translated in some ways, or worldly wealth, unrighteous mammon, worldly wealth. It has to do with wealth. It can't be actually sure that this saying, as these sayings of Jesus, did occur at the same time as this parable, this poem. But if it's not the case, well, certainly Luke has put them together, maybe to deal with any misunderstandings we might have about the parable. So we might think that the parable is a little story about how to be sneaky in making money and looking good. See, so maybe Luke puts alongside of it a very stern parable about money, actually about wealth. But again, it raises the question of how clever do we think we are? The attraction of wealth and living for wealth and trying to sort of make decisions about wealth that orientate around our own happiness and our own well-being and our own feeling of things are going well is to act foolishly. We haven't got it right, but it dominates our world. Wealth, getting everything right, accumulating the good for ourselves, is getting it wrong. It's not being very clever at all. Won't go through the poem in detail. I think we've got enough time. The first part of it, though, is a little difficult. It says something like this. I tell you, use unrighteous wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be received into eternal dwellings. Very difficult to understand, to be honest. Who are these friends? I think one take on it, and it's not an unreasonable take, is that in fact it's a reference to the poor of the world. Luke's gospel contains, and this is a parable and poem that occurs in Luke's gospel, contains almost every known saying we have that Jesus made about wealth. Not quite, but almost every single saying that Jesus made about money in particular is recorded in Luke's gospel. And almost every saying that Jesus makes about money has to do with helping the poor. See, words don't help the poor. They need material assistance. And maybe making friends of the poor who will appreciate your concern and your attempts to assist them materially. And maybe the idea is that they somehow will welcome you at the end of the age when you go into God's presence. They will say, ah, there were those people who came to my aid. They knew I was in need and they came to my aid. That may be it. Some people actually say that the friends might be a sort of a ancient way of referring to the angelic world, and when it refers to they will welcome you, that's a sort of an ancient way of referring to God will welcome you by using the plural. You don't use directly his name. I'll pass on to the second bit of the poem. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with? And what I'll now give is the actual form of the Greek, who will trust you with the truth? The word riches is not there. Again, it's a problem, but how do you actually understand the poem? I think what Jesus may be saying at this point is this. If you aren't clever enough to handle wealth the right way, why should I give into your hands the responsibility of proclaiming the truth of the gospel to the world? Why should I give, as it were, the truth that so concerns myself, my son, who he is and what he's done? Why should I say this is your charge, this is your responsibility, this is your amazing gift to the world if you are so obsessed by wealth and accumulating wealth in your world? And then, of course, he finishes the little poem with, you cannot serve two masters, you can only serve one or the other. It has to be either God himself or wealth. Which way do you go? So there you go. How to be really clever. One, know that we're in desperate need, and only the merciful God who gave us the Lord Jesus can deal with our problem. Two, how to be really clever. Don't live for wealth. Assist the poor. Proclaim the gospel. Serve God only, not wealth. Got some comments, ideas? Yep. Yes. Yes.
He's saying to the Pharisees, you know, use your world of wealth, gain friends, and you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings, idiots. Something like that, or didn't ever use sarcasm. Because in verse 10, he completely changes it.
Yes.
And says, look, if you can't be trusted with little,
yes.
You can't be trusted with much.
Yes.
And he's sort of, on the first half, he's almost handing to the Pharisees, saying, this is your world, this is how you're doing it.
Yes.
But in the second half, he's then sort of tearing it apart.
Yes, here's that. Look, that. Look, that could be. It's interesting. Well, it's interesting what happens at verse 10, is it, or verse 9, and I say unto you, there's a little linkage there which sort of makes it separate, what he's about to say, a little separate than the parable itself. And it's interesting right at the end, which the little bit we didn't deal with, the Pharisees are hearing all this. To begin with, at the opening part of the chapter, it's clear that Jesus is talking to the disciples. But the Pharisees are hearing all this, and they are very disturbed and very annoyed. So look, what you've said, you know, makes some sense. Yeah, yeah. As I said, it is the most difficult parable, and the first part of the poem is actually very difficult to understand, making friends and whatever. Got any other comments or ideas? You might say, Barry, why on earth did you do this to us? Like, well, every now and Any comments?
Just that, yes. You chose the parish to preach on, Barry, and why did you do it to yourself?
Because it's part of Scripture, and because you can't keep on avoiding hard things. There was an easier set of two parables I was going to talk about, and I thought, yeah, that would be helpful. And you have to think in terms of what is helpful. And I thought, I think that deep down this is helpful, although it will be tricky as to how we handle some of the details. So it was a sort of a challenge, I suppose, but I thought it would be not inappropriate. It mustn't do things because they're a challenge, you know, like, oh, it's a challenge, I think I'll do that. But I thought I ought to do it, I ought to try it. I am very dependent upon a fellow called Kenneth Bailey. Kenneth Bailey is one of the world's English speaking, if not beyond that, experts on the parables of Jesus. He's lived many, many years in the Middle East. He actually can speak or write Arabic, ancient Arabic. He can actually quote, you know, from a 4th century Arabic writer and tell you what he said about the parable and so on. So he's very, very learned. But however, some parts of it are entirely my own, and the idea that the sons of the children of light in their own world, attaching it to them is my position. In the Greek, it is actually more closely aligned with that than, in fact, the sons of their own age. It's actually attached. It comes exactly after the sons of light. So my impulse is let's attach it to the sons of light. And he doesn't make any comment about what in their own age means. And I think people should have tackled that. In their own age is a very strange thing to insert. But I think it might mean in their own club. It's Jesus' way. Well, it's the Greek way of handling what Jesus said in Aramaic, of saying in their own club, within their own club. They love righteousness. They know what righteousness is all about. Ha ha, that's them. They've got so many tickets on themselves. And that's why, in the end, I think the Pharisees, hearing whatever is being said, are very angry and very annoyed, because they think that actually wealth is a sign of God's blessing. This was very popular in the day of Jesus. If you were a very wealthy person, well, then obviously God was very kind. You were a very noble person, and God had endowed you with all this wealth. Yep. Yes. Yes, it did. Yes, look, again, in the parable, in the parable of the prodigal son, this occurred just earlier. There's nothing wrong with the father. The father is painted in the most noble of lights. In fact, he does the unusual thing. That is, he gets his skirts up and he runs to meet the son. No decent Oriental male would ever pull up his skirts in public and run. It was just absolutely unseemly. So the story that Jesus creates there is of a very, very noble person. I think he's doing exactly the same with the rich man, the rich man who owns the estate. He is portrayed as a very merciful, kind-hearted, and although the twist to the story in the Oriental world is he actually says, well, given that they think I'm so generous, I'd better beat you at that generous. That's the twist to it. What is interesting is, if you're just a sort of an Oriental person in the day of Jesus listening to this story, you're very happy with the cunning estate manager, but you're not happy with the fact he keeps on being called dishonest. He actually is the dishonest manager. And Jesus calls him the dishonest manager in the story. So he's not whitewashed at all, but what does come through is this extraordinary kindness, I think, compassionate man, which he plays on, which he needs. He needs this compassionate manager to survive, this compassionate landowner to survive. I think I'd better just pray, and then you're going to finish. Heavenly Father, you know our ignorance. You know how many things we do get wrong. Do we pray that you will help us to get the main things right. Help us to get the main things right of our own need of you and of your graciousness towards us, of our need to live for you, to proclaim the truth, and not to live for wealth. Please help us to see how wise you are and learn from you how to be wise ourselves. Please help us in this area. Amen.